B. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. It's 1:33. Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome for this oral argument Franklin High School. Would the students please stand? Well, it's good having you with us. Please be seated. The class from Franklin High School is here with the Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. These students have received material about the case we are about to hear and may have engaged in various discussions about this case. And were they here at lunch?
They yes. Sure were.
Good.
It was a good group.
Part of the program of Court with Class is that these students meet with a justice of the court at lunchtime to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case. So we're delighted you've come. I take Justice Bradley's word for it that you are a good group and participated well at lunch. But let me introduce you to the court. We've already met Justice Bradley, but let me introduce you to the court. Starting on my far right is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. She says, you did a good job, but we're not going to ask whether she did a good job. And to her left is Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Patience Rogensack. With the introductions made, we're going to call our case for this afternoon and our last case scheduled for the December calendar, 02-1287-CR State versus Henning. Representing the state is Assistant Attorney General Stephen Kleinmeier. Mr. Kleinmeier.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin, which is the plaintiff, respondent, petitioner in this case. This is here when after the court granted the state's petition for review to consider the decision of the Court of Appeals that reversed Mr. Henning's bail jumping convictions in order that he could not be retried on those convictions. Just to briefly summarize the facts in the trial court, just to cover the basic procedures, Mr. Henning was charged with three counts of bail jumping, two misdemeanor and one felony count, and two drug charges, one possession of marijuana with intent to deliver and one possession of LSD with intent to deliver. And the theory was that he violated bail conditions when he committed those two drug crimes. Case was submitted to the jury, and the jury sent back a couple questions. After the questions were answered, the jury returned its verdict, acquitting him of the two drug charges, finding him guilty of the three bail jumping charges. He appealed the bail jumping convictions, and the Court of Appeals agreed with the trial court that the jury must have acted on the theory that even though he didn't possess drugs with intent to deliver, he did possess them, and it was the possession of the drugs. It was on the basis of that that he convicted of bail jumping.
Can I just ask you a question?
Yes.
Mr. Kleinmeier, suppose that he had been charged with possession of drugs, not the intent to deliver, but just straight possession, and he was acquitted of that. Found not guilty. Okay? Could you then bring a bail jumping charge against him?
In a successive prosecution?
In a successive prosecution.
Yeah, of course, that was our theory, that's not. But I think that's where we get to the Dixon theory, the incorporation theory.
I just want to Do it simple first so I can understand.
Okay, well, Your Honor, I'm afraid I don't think it's simple.
Nothing's simple.
No, in double jeopardy, I don't think anything's simple. Well, I actually think part of this case, the retrial, is simple. On your example, though, it would be the state's theory that, yes, they could bring it because they are they constitute different offenses, that bail, that the possession is not incorporated or is not a lesser included offense of bail jumping under Wisconsin law and under Blockberger.
Yeah, and I looked at the instructions, and the first element is just that the defendant was charged with a felony. You never have to show on bail jumping that he's guilty.
No, because he's out. It's just because he's out on bail. So the bail may be even before he ever goes to trial.
Yeah, but there's a condition of bail that he not commit a crime.
Right.
And if he's just arrested for a crime, we don't know whether he committed it or not, do we?
Well, let me back up a minute then, because I guess I'm not making a connection here. What, he's charged with his original charge, whatever that may be, make it a felony of some kind. He's released on bail.
Right.
While that case is pending, he goes out and possesses drugs. He's charged with bail jumping. When he was submitted, when he gets bail for that felony, one of the conditions is he not commit any crime.
Right.
And then he goes out while the felony is still pending. He's charged with possession of drugs.
It's a different one than the predicate, than the original.
For the original felony, yes, a totally different crime. Because he committed the second crime, or he's alleged to have committed the second crime, then he's charged with bail jumping.
Right.
In this case, then they went to trial together, and to determine whether he, part of the bail jumping is, you know, you have to decide then whether he committed another crime. A conviction is not required for bail. He doesn't have to be, under Hauk case, doesn't have to be convicted of the other crime to be convicted of bail jumping, but they'd have to show in the bail jumping he did commit the crime.
You have to prove it anyway.
You have to show it, yes.
So you have to prove it. Do you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt?
I'm assuming you do.
So if you're going to get convicted of bail jumping, the state has to prove all the elements of the crime committed that is a violation of the condition.
Yeah, they have to prove it, but under this court's decision, I think it's pronounced Jacobus case, when you're charged with bail jumping, you're not being prosecuted for that underlying conduct, whether it was commission of a crime or violation of some other condition of bail that's set for bail jumping. In Jacobus, it was he wasn't supposed to get drunk, wasn't supposed to drink. And the bail jumping was based on the fact that after he was out on bail, he went out and got drunk. And the claim was he couldn't be prosecuted criminally for being drunk. And this court held when you're on bail jumping, you're not being prosecuted for that conduct.
Right, but that was different because drinking and being drunk is not a crime. It may be a violation of a condition, but it's not a crime.
No, but what was significant in that case was if he was being prosecuted, if the bail jumping constituted a prosecution, criminal prosecution of that underlying conduct of drunkenness, then it was prohibited by another statute. So the court held that when you're charged with bail jumping, you're not being prosecuted criminally for that underlying conduct, only for the violation of the bail.
Right. What about Hansford? In Hansford, we said, because the bail jumping conviction was premised solely on the defendant's obstructing conviction, which we now reverse, the bail jumping conviction must also be reversed. Absent defining that the defendant committed a crime, the state has not proved beyond a reasonable doubt an element of the bail jumping charge.
Well, I think maybe in that case it was...
It's not cited in your brief, I don't think.
No. Because I think, again, it was maybe been the circumstances the way that case was tried, because you don't have to show that the bail jumping crime statute normally doesn't require that you prove that he was conviction of the other crime. It doesn't have to be charged and convicted separately. It just appears in the Hansford case, and I think in that case, the other crime, that was the one that was set aside because of the six-person jury. Mm-hmm. So that other underlying conviction was set aside on that ground.
Right.
But the question of that, how that would relate to our case, I think, would be then whether he could be retried on a bail jumping and go back and do it again. And I don't think that came up in that case.
Well, as a matter of law, the defendant's conviction was reversed.
Yeah, but it doesn't say that they couldn't be retried.
So you think it could be retried?
Yes. Since, I mean, that underlying conviction was reversed because of the six-person jury, so I'm assuming it could be retried on that one with a full jury. So I don't know why he could have been retried for the bail jumping.
Okay.
Anyway, in this case, I think that in not permitting the state to retry Mr. Henning for bail jumping, the Court of Appeals was contrary to a very basic rule that's applied by the United States Supreme Court and this Court. It says, after reversal of a conviction, it's not denial of double jeopardy to retry a defendant unless the reversal is based on insufficiency of the evidence or for there are some kinds of prosecutorial misconduct for which you can't retry him if it's reversed on that ground. Well, this wasn't reversed on those grounds. In fact, the Court of Appeals specifically said it would have found the evidence sufficient to convict. So therefore, it just seems to me that since it wasn't reversed for that, under this other rule, very, very basic rule, the state should be permitted to retry Mr. Henning on the bail jumping charge.
Mr. Kleinmeier, I think you handled this case for the state in the Court of Appeals. Is that right?
Yes.
Did you concede in the Court of Appeals that the three bail jumping convictions should be reversed?
No. We disputed the arguments over the jury the question. The main issues in the Court of Appeals were over whether the trial court properly answered the jury's questions that came out during their deliberations. And we argued against Mr. Henning in the Court of Appeals on that. The way it was resolved by the Court of Appeals on those issues, frankly, I didn't think it was the kind of issues that qualified for review here. And I didn't necessarily think that they were wrong. I mean, it was kind of the procedures in the trial court were a little unusual. And so the fact that they reversed the convictions, I guess I didn't find surprising. And because of the strange circumstances of this trial, I just didn't think it was, you know, qualified for review for this court. But I think that the fact that they find they can't retry them all, I think that's the issue that's different from the general case law and sets bad precedent in the published opinion.
Is it your conclusion that the question of the three convictions for three guilty verdicts for bail jumping is simply not before us and cannot be considered by us?
I think, no, it's not my position on that, because I think the case this Court's held in other cases that once this case is here, the Court can consider any part of the case. Now, I never raised any of those issues in the petition for review, and those underlying issues haven't been argued in the briefs. But, I mean, as far as the case here, I think on the basis of other cases, I mean, this Court said it's here, everything's here.
Could I come back to the Chief Justice's first question? I thought I read in your brief that if you prevail here and we have a new trial, you cannot charge possession with intent to deliver because that has been decided in a previous trial.
Yeah, he's been acquitted of that, yes.
The Chief Justice then asked, if we had a case in which possession was the issue, possession of a controlled substance was the issue, and that was decided unfavorably. But to be consistent with your brief, you would have said, well, we can't try it on that issue either.
Well, Your Honor, I did not understand the question to be that he had been acquitted of the drug charge. I just understood that he'd been...
The question was he was charged with and acquitted with possession. Now, in a successive prosecution, can you charge him with violating a condition of bail, the condition being not to commit a crime? and the crime is possession for which he's already been acquitted. You can't try, we agree, on double jeopardy basis. You can't try him for possession again. My question is, recognizing that, can you charge him with bail jumping?
Okay. If he's been acquitted in that drug charge the first time, I think not because of collateral estoppel. It's already been a finding of fact that he didn't possess it, and because of collateral estoppel aspects, I don't think
you
charge him.
If you had the evidence, could you charge him with using drugs in violation of the conditions of bail, but other than a violation of law or another crime, I guess?
Yes, another crime you could. And I think this gets – these questions relate, I think, to the theory used by the trial court and that Mr. Henning uses that – or that they're getting very close anyway. And I think that the Dixon case shows that he can be tried on these other ones. In part of Dixon is the part 3B of Justice Scalia's opinion that deals with Mr. Foster's case, not Mr. Dixon's, Mr. Foster's. And in his contempt case, he was charged with contempt because he violated the condition of the court's order by assaulting his wife. That was the contempt case based on assault of his wife. He was then turned around and charged criminally with assault intent to kill. Justice Scalia said that was proper. When you compare contempt with assault with assault to kill, they are different crimes because with contempt, you have to show that he knew about the court's order. With assault to kill, you have to show they had the intention to kill. Even though they shared the two crimes, the two greater crimes of the contempt based on assault and the assault to kill, the two greater crimes, they shared the lesser of assault, the lesser included crime of assault. Justice Scalia said you could still charge him with that assault to kill. He said the fact that two of the greater crimes share a lesser does not mean that you're barred from charging the two greater crimes separately. He also illustrated that later in the opinion with an example based on Harris versus Oklahoma. Harris versus Oklahoma, the person was convicted of felony murder because a murder was committed while he was committing robbery with a firearm. The state then turned around and tried to charge him with robbery with a firearm separately, and the Supreme Court said no. It was later explained that that's a species of lesser-included crime. As the eight of the justices explained in the Grady versus Corbin, the Harris versus Oklahoma does not meet the strict Blockberger test for being the same offense, but it was found to be a same offense because it's a species of lesser-included. Now, in the example given by Justice Scalia based on Harris versus Oklahoma in the Dixon case, he said, let's change the facts a little. Assume Mr. Harris was charged with felony murder because he committed a robbery, and then he's later charged with robbery with a firearm. He said that's permissible because in the felony murder, they didn't have to prove he had a firearm, and robbery with a firearm, you don't have to prove the murder. So even though the two, robbery with a firearm and the felony murder, both have robbery as a lesser-included offense, the fact that the two greater crimes, when compared to one another, are separate indicates that they can be charged separately. Now, back to your example, went all through that because the fact that the second crime you cited, use of drugs, the fact that that carries different elements from possession, I think that means that then even under Justice Scalia's analysis, you could charge the later bail jumping could be based on the use of the drugs.
Well, is there another crime here that he could be charged with in bail jumping? Or isn't that really what you're doing here?
Well, I think if he goes back for retrial, he's going to be charged with bail jumping based on possession, not possession with intent to deliver.
Another charge than possession, because it's my understanding from your restatement of the answer to my question that had he been charged with and acquitted of possession of drugs, you could not pick him up on bail, you cannot prosecute him on bail jumping.
Like for collateral estoppel, yes.
Okay. That's collateral estoppel, and the argument would be because that's what the jury found. Now, in this case, he's charged with possession with intent to sell.
Yes.
That's the only charge for which they're given instructions.
The only drug charge, yes.
on a successive prosecution, you could not prosecute him for the lesser included of possession. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. That's what I just went through. That's exactly what.
So you can't charge him with that.
Wait a minute. You can, yes, you can.
Pardon me?
I'm saying you can charge bail jumping based on the lesser. That's Justice Scalia's decision on Foster, Part 3B of the Dixon case. Scalia's.
Lesser included offense, you can charge him?
Because he wasn't, the jury didn't charge, didn't have any verdict on the lesser included offense. I understand that that in a way it doesn't make sense, but that's what Justice Scalia says.
Well, that's my point. That was my next question, Mr. Kleinmeier. What kind of sense does this make? And he did not get a majority of the court.
I don't think his underlying position makes sense, where he says that a felony can be a lesser included offense of basically a misdemeanor. I think where he says the contempt case in Dixon was similar to Harris versus Oklahoma. And it's similar in the sense that, as Harris said, that for a felony murder, it incorporated, I think, all felonies as a possibility. In the contempt case, it incorporated the whole criminal code. Where it differs, however, and I think it's a significant difference, is in Harris versus Oklahoma, you have the typical lesser included offense situation, where a felony murder is going to take into account, when it gives a penalty, it takes into account the underlying conduct of the other felony. Whereas in contempt and in bail jumping, you don't do that. In bail jumping, you're not punished at all for the actual conduct of the underlying crime. You're punished only for violating the conditions of bail. For example, if you're out on bail on a misdemeanor, if you charge with bail jumping, that's misdemeanor bail jumping. If you commit a murder or any other serious felony while on bail, you can be then charged with bail jumping based on that murder. Well, when it comes to sentencing, the maximum sentence on bail jumping is 9 months. You're not being punished for that bail jumping for the underlying conduct of murder. And in Gordon, this court said that typically a lesser included offense, when they set the penalty for the greater and the lesser included, that the greater offense takes into account the conduct and the penalty already for the lesser offense. Well, that part of the analysis from Harris versus Oklahoma doesn't carry over to bail jumping, because there's no accounting for bail jumping doesn't penalize in any way for that underlying criminal conduct. But that's what we have Justice Scalia's opinion. And the thing is, on the Part 3B dealing with Foster, where it says the two greaters don't share a lesser, Justice Rehnquist did join that part. In Dixon, let's see, it should be 509 U.S., page 719, footnote 3. It says, because Justice Scalia finds no double jeopardy bar with respect to those counts, and this is Mr. Foster's, I agree with the result reached in 3B of his opinion. Which is the part that I've been citing, where the two graders can share the same lesser without becoming the same offense.
Counselor, could you address the stipulation that the district attorney entered into and the argument that's made that by the stipulation, paragraph 3, the state changed the nature of this bail jumping charge in that one of the elements had to be possession with intent to deliver?
I don't think that's made on the Supreme Court. At least I didn't understand that. But I don't think that the stipulation changes the elements of the crime, in part because that stipulation was not only because of something the prosecutor wanted. The stipulation came about because the defense before trial didn't want any evidence to come in of these underlying crimes. So in other words, both sides benefited from that stipulation, and I don't think the stipulation can change the elements of the crime. I want to point out that, first of all, we've been talking all this about successive prosecution. A retrial is not a successive prosecution. A retrial after reversal of conviction. This court and the U.S. Supreme Court has talked about a continuation of a proceedings when you merely go back for retrial after reversal. It's all the same proceeding. You're just seeking one fair and just trial, they say. And also in the Tateo case, which we cite in the reply brief, They just give us a policy reason that you've got to be permitted to retry people after reversal of the convictions, because otherwise it's too stiff a penalty to impose on the public that people go free because of an error committed during that first trial. And so I think it should be reversed, should be permitted to have a retrial just on that theory without even worrying about successive prosecutions.
Well, here the jury found, what, not guilty with intent to deliver, right?
Right.
Was there any error there? I mean, now there's no error.
No. I mean,
and the jury then found in the same trial that there was a bail jumping. Apparently, and I guess the state agrees to this, that the basis, the crime, the predicate crime was possession, right?
Yeah.
Does the jury have to be given an instruction on the underlying crime?
That's what the Court of Appeals held in this case.
Well, okay, do you agree with that?
It makes sense. I mean, if they're supposed to find the person guilty of bail jumping for having committed a crime, if they're not told what the elements of that crime are, I'm not sure how they can determine they committed it.
And they weren't told here.
No. And that's one of the reasons it's reversed, for an error in instructions.
All right. And you say that, could the jury have brought in a conviction of possession?
No, there was no verdict on that to do it.
But the jury, but in a successive prosecution, can you now charge him with possession?
No, because that's the lesser included of the acquitted crime.
So you can't charge him with possession, but you can use it as a predicate here. And the doctrine is not double jeopardy, but collateral estoppel, because there was no finding by the jury, is that?
Right. In fact, the jury, as the trial court found, I mean, this thing's pretty clear. As the trial court said, that with the jury's theory, when you look at their questions, was that he didn't intend to deliver it, but they did possess it, just didn't intend to deliver it. I mean, one of their questions was, if we find him not guilty of, they used the numbers, but if we find him not guilty of possession with intent to deliver, can we still find him guilty of another crime, the other crime being possession? And then they came back with the guilty of the bail jumping. So it's pretty clear from their instructions they were thinking of possession.
So you wouldn't have to give another instruction the defendant would be collaterally estopped from denying possession in the next case?
No, I don't think collateral estoppel works against the defendant that way. The state would still have to prove all the elements again.
Is there any evidence that this jury was confused about the offenses?
No, maybe the evidence was that they probably did understand, that their understanding didn't match the instructions, but, some of the disputed parts of the trial were, I mean, the defendant disputed both whether he possessed the drugs and whether they were possessed with intent to deliver. I mean, there was a relatively small amount in the sense, in terms of dollars. Each was about $100 worth of each drug, I think. The state relied on some other, like some piece of paper with some numbers on it, found the defendant. The state thought that was numbers relating to drug transactions. The defense put on a witness said, no, it's just numbers relating to scoring of a card game. So, I mean, they disputed both parts of it. And so, because of the way the case was tried, I can understand how a jury may say, yeah, we think he possessed them, but we don't think he intended to deliver them. I mean, I don't know if that really answers your question or not, but I mean, to the extent that the jury thought that way, I think it was understandable in light of the way the case was tried.
What I'm really getting at is, in the second question asked by the jury, didn't they clearly indicate, if we don't find the defendant guilty of possession with intent to deliver, but do find the defendant guilty of possession of a controlled substance, can we find a bail jumping on those offenses? I mean, is there anything unclear about what was in the jury's state of mind here?
No, I think it was at least similar to that. I mean, I don't know if I'd phrase it quite the same way. I don't know if they were saying they have to find him guilty of possession, but I think they just said if we find that he possessed it, but without intent to deliver, can we still find him guilty of bail jumping? And I think that's clearly what, I mean, that came across, and I think that's what the trial court said. That's clearly what they had in mind, is really reported, relayed by their series of questions. Time is up here.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. Mr. Phillips.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Phillips, and I represent Wyatt Henning in this case. I guess I'd like to begin with an observation by Justice Rehnquist in discussing the law on successive prosecutions, in which he stated that the decisional law in this area is a veritable Sargasso Sea, which could not fail to challenge the most intrepid judicial navigator. And I guess at least the first half of this argument would seem to be consistent with Justice Rehnquist's observation. My hope is that the facts of this case do not get lost in the Sargasso Sea of the law, and that the court not lose sight of exactly why we're here today. And I would contend that the reason that we're here is that the prosecution in this case simply overcharged Mr. Henning. It bit off more than it could chew. It brought charges against him that it could not prove to the jury's satisfaction. And not only did that, but put all its eggs in one basket, so to speak, by basing the bail jumping charges solely on the greater offense of possession with intent to deliver. And it stuck with that strategy through the pretrial hearings, through the negotiation of the stipulation with the defense attorney, through the opening statements, through the evidentiary portion of the trial, in the jury instructions conference when it failed to request a lesser included offense, failed to change its theory as to how Mr. Henning was supposedly guilty of bail jumping. Through the closing arguments, and even through the first jury question that came to the court, when the jury understandably asked, you know, we've never been given what the conditions of this bond were. What are the conditions, and how did he supposedly violate it? And it was at that point that the trial court informed the jury quite properly that the theory was that Mr. Henning had possessed drugs with intent to deliver them. Prosecutor never suggested that they were relying on any lesser degree of crime here. Apparently, when the second question came in, the prosecutor realized at the last second that this case was quickly going down the drain for her. And at that point, the strategy changed. When it became apparent that the jury was thinking about acquitting Mr. Henning of the possession with intent to deliver charges, and also wanted to know if it had to then acquit him of the bail jumping charges, that's when the prosecutor changed her strategy and encouraged the court successfully to instruct the jury, well, no, now you can simply consider whether Mr. Henning was guilty of bail jumping because of simple possession of the drugs. Basically what this is the state changing their entire strategy after the case has been tried, after the jury has begun deliberations, after the jury's been instructed on the theories of law, and now after that strategy has proven to be unsuccessful, now they want another chance. They basically want a do-over.
Mr. Phillips, in your rendition of the facts, the jury asked two different questions. When the first question was answered, when a reference was made such as intent to deliver THC or LSD, that answer, if I read your brief correctly, was approved by both parties.
Right. And that, I'm not suggesting that that was incorrect. That was entirely correct. Right.
And if the answer had been simply any crime, I don't think your party would have agreed to that, would they?
No, they probably wouldn't, because that's not the theory on which the parties had understood the case to be tried.
Well, I have the stipulation here, and I suspect you have the stipulation. Where is it in the stipulation that the conviction for bail jumping exclusively depends on a finding of guilty, either one of those possession with intent to deliver?
I agree, Your Honor. It's not in there. It's in there implicitly, I would suggest. But I'm not just relying on the stipulation itself. Throughout the case, the prosecutor argued that, I mean, the only thing she did argue throughout the case was that the bail jumping was based on possession with intent to deliver, not any other crime. And the jury was instructed on that basis, and they were never instructed as to any other crimes that Mr. Henning may have committed. So it would be very difficult for the jury to, at that point, start considering other crimes that he may have committed.
Well, on the bail jumping instruction, there are three elements to bail jumping, as I understand it, and two of them are conceded on the basis of the stipulation.
Correct.
The third element, didn't that relate basically to the claim by the defendant that the drugs weren't his?
Well, that was the defense, exactly, that the drugs weren't his. It was also suggested during the trial that in cross-examination of the police officer that the drugs, which only amounted to approximately $200 worth of drugs, were not necessarily intended to be delivered, that they could have been for personal possession. And it was at that point that the alternative defense presented itself. But the state strategy throughout, as was the defense strategy, quite honestly, because neither side asked for a lesser included offense instruction, both sides had the strategy of going all or nothing. And what I'm suggesting is that the state went all or nothing, then decided once things started looking bad for it that now it wanted to change its strategy at the very end of the game, and now they want essentially a do-over. And that's what the Double Jeopardy Clause is all about.
This, in your view, this is a double jeopardy case?
Yes.
Is this a case involving a second prosecution for the same offense after acquittal, or a prosecution for the same offense after conviction?
Actually, I don't think it matters in the successive prosecution area. Under the case law in successive prosecutions, you cannot be successively prosecuted whether you were convicted or acquitted the first time. As long as there was a resolution of the case in the first trial, you cannot be prosecuted again for the same offense. And so where we are in this case is that Mr. Henning was prosecuted on possession with intent to deliver. He was acquitted, but it doesn't matter, even if he had been convicted.
But he wasn't acquitted of bail jumping.
No, he wasn't.
So it's not second prosecution after acquittal, is it?
Well, I guess what you're basically asking is about the state's position in its brief, which is this continuing jeopardy theory that because Mr. Henning was convicted of the bail jumpings, but those convictions have been reversed, the jeopardy continues on that charge so that now he can be tried again because the jeopardy never terminated. And I guess that position, the cases that have adopted that theory have been in much more simplistic fact situations. They've usually involved a single count in which the person gets convicted and then retried. And the courts have always held, well, when the convictions are overturned, the jeopardy continues. We more or less consider that first trial to be a nullity. The jeopardy has never terminated, and you can be retried again on the same charge. And if this case had simply involved bail jumping prosecutions, and for whatever reason, Mr. Henning was convicted and then the convictions were overturned, I would agree that there would be nothing in the Double Jeopardy Clause to preclude him from being retried again. But I think what the state is missing in this case is that it's not, we didn't just have the bail jumping charges that were tried the first time. We also had the possession with intent to deliver charges. And it's the trial on those counts that precludes a retrial for the same offenses now.
Well, was he acquitted of possession? Simple possession?
He was not acquitted of simple possession. However, he cannot be retried on simple possession because it's a lesser of possession with intent.
Right. So the acquittal goes right down the line of all lesser.
Correct.
Okay.
He cannot be retried for simple possession of the drugs. He cannot be tried for possession with intent to deliver the drugs. And I would contend, although I know Mr. Kleinmeier disagrees, but under Dixon, he can't be retried for bail jumping based on possession with intent to deliver either, because that incorporates possession with intent. So he can't be retried for any of those things because they're all the same offense. Simple possession is also the same offense because it's a lesser included of an offense which has already been tried, possession with intent to deliver.
Make the best case you can for the proposition that a decision has been made once and for all that this defendant did not possess controlled substances on January 25th of whatever year that was.
Well, that's not really the basis for my argument that they have found him not guilty of possession. The basis for my argument is that they have tried him for something that is considered to be the same offense already. I'm not arguing that there's any, that because the jury has found him not guilty of something that they can't, that they necessarily found him not guilty of possession.
Well, if they didn't find him, why should the state be collaterally stopped from asserting possession here if the jury didn't make an adverse finding on that?
Well, I'm not making the collateral estoppel argument. That's a distinct argument from successive prosecutions.
Don't you have to respond to it, counsel? You might not be making it. You don't agree with it. You don't like it. It might be bad for your plan, but it's been made, and it has some appeal.
Well, I would concede that the state is not collaterally stopped from prosecuting Mr. Henning for bail jumping based on simple possession. But that is just one segment of double jeopardy. The reason that they're not collaterally estopped is because under the collateral estoppel doctrine, the defendant has the burden of proving that the issue was already resolved in the first trial. And as Justice Prosser's questions suggest, I can't carry that burden. I acknowledge that because there at least is some confusion, putting it in Henning's best light, some confusion as to what the jury may have decided. They could have decided that he didn't possess the drugs at all. Given the questions that the jury asked and the sequence of how this whole thing occurred, it's more likely that they concluded that he didn't have the intent to deliver. But whatever the case, I cannot prove, as I would have to do in the collateral estoppel context, that the jury necessarily resolved the issue that you're talking about.
Well, but then your position has to be that collateral estoppel is not the issue and that double jeopardy concepts override collateral estoppel.
Right.
That's your position.
Right. That is my position.
And they override for what reason?
Because all of these offenses are the same offense for one reason or another. Either they're lesser included of each other, or using the incorporation analysis adopted in Dixon, which this court, by the way, has already endorsed, I believe, in Kurzawa, based either on the lesser included offense doctrine or the incorporation analysis, all of these offenses are the same offense. You know, there's a certain appeal to the suggestion that, well, we're not really trying him for possession of the drugs. We're trying him for the bail jump. And Mr. Kleinmeier cites the Jacobus case. The Jacobus case was not a double jeopardy case. The issue there was not whether there was no same offense analysis in Jacobus. Under the Dixon and Blockberger analysis, my contention is if possession with intent and simple possession are the same offense, and simple possession and bail jumping based on simple possession are the same offense, then you can't try somebody for bail jumping based on simple possession.
Well, how do you get bail jumping and possession as the same offense?
If the bail jumping is based on simple possession, which I believe the state is acknowledging it would have to be at this point.
They'd have to prove it. That's what he said.
They have to prove it, exactly. I mean, you can say, well, sure, the gravamen of the offense, I think that was the language used in Jacobus, the gravamen of the offense may be bail jumping. But what do they have to prove? They have to prove that he committed a crime, and they have to prove each element of the crime that they claim he committed. And once they're doing that, they're proving the possession offense. And that's exactly the offense that cannot be retried at this point.
Can't be retried as a separate offense.
Correct.
Therefore, your position is they can't retry it within another offense.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, if you have another trial in this case, there's not going to be any argument as to whether Mr. Henning knew that he was on bond, or whether he had been released on bond, whether he knew the conditions of the bond. The argument's going to be whether he committed a crime.
So that crime is
simple possession.
What about Scalia's argument?
Well, I think he uses several examples in that case that, you know, really aren't germane to the issue here. And some of the cases that he cites are like, I know one was an old English common law case involving burglary with intent and burglary with intent to steal and burglary involving actually stealing the goods. And I don't think that, you know, that kind of example is comparable to what we have here, where bail jumping actually encompasses and incorporates the elements of the offense which supposedly constitutes the violation of the bond. I think there's been a few questions about how we can prevent this sort of thing from coming up again, and I guess I have a couple of suggestions on that. Number one, it probably would be desirable for the state in its charging documents to have to identify exactly what conditions they are claiming were violated, and if it's, you know, the alleged commission of a crime, identifying the crime that they say was committed. That way everybody will be on the same page when it gets to trial, and there won't be any surprises in the midst of deliberations like occurred in this case. And even more desirable would be a modification of the jury instruction for this specific situation. I mean, in most cases where the bail jumping simply involves, violating curfew or failing to make a court appearance or something that isn't a crime, it's perfectly fine to have the standard instruction say, you know, violating a condition of the bond. But in this particular case, the jury didn't even know, because of the stipulation, the jury never saw the bond. The bond was not introduced into evidence They didn't know that the commission of a crime was a condition of the bond. It probably would have been better if the court had pointed that out before the jury asked that first question, that, you know, the conditions of the bond are such and such. The state claims that that Mr. Henning violated the condition, saying that he not commit a crime, and the state is alleging that the crime that was committed was whatever the state's position on that is. And had the jury been instructed to begin with that way, then they never would have come back with those two questions. And for all practical purposes, I think it's very easy to see that Mr. Henning would have been acquitted on all five charges. Because, you know, as this case went to the jury, the state's position was he violated the bond by possessing with intent to deliver. They found that he didn't commit that crime.
Now, the jury was told about this stipulation, right?
Right.
And when it was...
Several times.
Pardon me?
Several times. It was read to them, yes.
When it was given the jury instruction for bail jumping, was the instruction say anything about what the underlying crime was?
No, and I guess that's my point. The instruction just follows the standard,
right,
you know, pattern instruction, which says simply that the defendant knew the conditions of the bond and knew that his conduct violated those conditions. Well, you know, that can be just about anything. In the situation that we have here, involving the commission of a crime as a bond violation, it would be preferable if the jury were told that, you know, that you can't commit another crime when you're on bond. That's a specific condition of your bond. And it should be told what crime it is that the state is alleging to have occurred.
But with that stipulation repeated, one would assume that they're told that the underlying crime is possession with intent.
Right.
And then unless they find him guilty of that, they have to get not
right.
find him guilty of
Yeah, and the stipulation, as I suggested before, the stipulation wasn't the only thing that would have given them that belief, because the case was argued that way in the opening statements, in the closing arguments, you know, everything up until the point of the second question that the jury came back with suggested that this case would rise or fall on possession with intent to deliver. I guess there's another concern that hasn't actually been addressed here, but I would like to comment on it anyway, and that is that, you know, I've read some of the other bail jumping cases that this court and the Court of Appeals have decided, and there's always the concern that for example, in Harris and Nelson, two earlier Court of Appeals cases, there's the statement that, you know, really we don't have the same offense here because bail jumping satisfies a separate concern of the legislature, and if we cannot prosecute both for the offense violating the bond and for bail jumping, then the state is losing something. Well, I would suggest, first of all, that the same offense analysis that we're using here and the successive prosecution analysis is a little bit different than the question of whether the state can prosecute in a single prosecution both bail jumping and the underlying offense. And that's what both Harris and Nelson deal with. You start at the same point with whether something is the same offense. But that's just the beginning of the question in the multiple punishment arena. And it's really the only question in the successive prosecution arena. So I guess my position is not necessarily that the legislature cannot punish or allow multiple punishments for both bail jumping and the substantive offense, as long as they clearly state their intent that that's allowable. And, you know, I guess that would be a future case for this court to decide whether that intent had been clearly stated by the legislature. And even aside from that, the state still has other options in promoting their interest in making sure that persons do not violate the conditions of their bond. They can, you know, aside from prosecuting for both offenses, you know, the defendant's bond can be revoked, his bail can be forfeited, the conditions of the bond can be changed, you know, additional terms can be added to the bond, and, you know, if for example, let's say the bond is violated by a rather innocuous criminal offense, such as disorderly conduct, the state can choose whether to prosecute for disorderly conduct or prosecute for bail jumping based on disorderly conduct. The latter offense may be more serious than the disorderly conduct itself, so the state still has the option of ensuring that their interest making defendants follow the conditions of bond is adequately preserved. I guess I have said what I wanted to say, unless anyone else has questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Mr. Kleinmeier, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Well, I'd just like to start out to get back to the more simple part of the solution of this case is so simply a request for a retrial. And after reversal of a conviction, and United States Supreme Court said pretty emphatically, United States versus Scott, 437 U.S. at pages 90 to 91, referring to Ball versus United States, said firmly established that a successful appeal of a conviction precludes a subsequent plea of double jeopardy, and that the successful appeal of a judgment of conviction on any ground other than the insufficiency of the evidence to support the verdict poses no bar to further prosecution on the same charge. Now, that's pretty strong language, I think. We don't have a reversal for insufficiency of the evidence here. It's based on errors in jury instructions and in the verdict. Therefore, under this language, the state's entitled to retry Mr. Henning. There was also a statement made that some of the examples given by Justice Scalia and Dixon are not germane to the case. Well, the case court gets to Dixon, I think that this discussion on Part 3B of Justice Scalia's opinion, which deals with Mr. Foster's case, that's the one I was discussing before, is very germane because the crimes and the comparisons made there are the same that the defendant is making in this case, where he says, because he's been acquitted of one greater crime, he can't be charged in a later case with bail jumping based on a crime where they are lesser included, they both share. And that's exactly what Justice Scalia was talking about in that case. Also, there's the argument made by the defendant that bail jumping and it's whatever crime it's based on are satisfy the Blockberger test for the same offense. And I don't think that's accurate at all. Relying mainly on the United States Supreme Court's analysis of Harris versus Oklahoma. Again, go back to the 8 justices. They're cited in the reply brief. 8 of the justices agreed that in the situation in Harris versus Oklahoma, which is felony murder, would not satisfy a strict application of the Blockberger test to reach a result of the same offense. They said they said that, and even Justice Scalia said there's something in addition to the Blockberger test that bars a subsequent case. And that's the Harris's incorporation theory. And as I was arguing before, I don't think that applies to bail jumping. There are some other consequences here if the court were in the course of this opinion, decide that bail jumping and the crime it's based on satisfy the Blockberger test as the same offense. Double jeopardy, and that the consequences could be whether the defendant, even in a single prosecution, could then be convicted of both the bail jumping and the underlying crime. The double jeopardy provisions wouldn't bar it. They say you look to legislative intent. But that's where in Wisconsin a couple statutes come into play. 93966 sub 1, which is the basic definition of an underlying offense, of a lesser included crime, this Court has said several times, is basically a restatement of Blockberger. So if this Court were to find that bail jumping and the crime that it's based on, the underlying crime, are the same offense under the Blockberger test, then when that's plugged into 93966, which talks about lesser included, which says you cannot convict someone of both the greater and the lesser, that means that in Wisconsin, a person could not be charged and convicted, even in the same prosecution, with bail jumping and the underlying crime. But that does get me back, it gets kind of circular, it gets back to this analysis of Harris versus Oklahoma, where even if this Court were to find that under that Harris incorporation analysis, bail jumping and the underlying crime are the same offense, that does not make it the same offense under Blockberger. Because, again, the justices distinguish Harris type analysis from the Blockberger test. But basically, I just, going back again to the first point, I don't think this is not a case of successive prosecution. It's simply a case of retrial after reversal. And they have basically a black letter law, a black letter rule, so you can do it after reversal. And the policy reasons given at the Tao case for allowing retrial after reversal, I think, apply in this kind of situation.
In Hansford, you have a trial on a substantive offense, and then you have the bail jumping. The Court says trial's not good on the substantive offense because it's a six-person jury. And therefore, the trial is no good on bail jumping, not because it's a six-person jury, but because you don't have the predicate offense anymore. Right?
Well, I think so.
Then it says that, and you were right, you could go back on retrying with 12, but on both. In this case, you can't retry him on the predicate offense. But you're saying you can try him on bail jumping based on the predicate offense.
Based on the possession, not the possession with intent to deliver.
But the predicate offense is possession, which you could not retry him on.
Correct. I mean, a straight possession charge, no, you can't. That's less included the other.
So, but you can then do it on another offense in which includes possession. That's the state's position.
Yes, and then again, I think this goes back to that black letter law about there's no bar except for collateral estoppel, and that wouldn't apply except for the intent to deliver aspect.
And it all rests on a continuation issue.
Well, the continuation issue and the policy arguments in the Tateo case, they said, you know, whether you call it a waiver theory, a continual proceeding, these policy reasons justify retrial after reversal.
And I agree. It's at a minimum a waiver. If you ask for a new trial on the basis of a defect, you can't then come and say no new trial.
Well, it's not even if you just ask, but we're not even arguing the waiver part about asking for it. These other theories also apply, especially the policy arguments in detail.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. Thank you, Mr. Phillips, for your argument on yet another double jeopardy collateral estoppel issue. And that concludes our hearings for today and our hearings on the December argument. The case, we are adjourned for oral arguments, and the Court will meet in the conference room at 3 p.m.